Simon Winchester has long been one of our most wide-ranging nonfiction storytellers, bringing curiosity and clarity to subjects as varied as dictionaries, oceans, earthquakes, and the technologies that have knit together the modern world. His new book, The Breath of the Gods, The History and Future of the Wind, continues that tradition with an expansive exploration of the invisible force that has shaped life on Earth since its beginning. The book is not only a history, Winchester also considers the planetary future at a time when intensifying winds, shifting jet streams, and increasingly volatile weather patterns signal profound environmental change. With his signature narrative sweep and global perspective, he illuminates how wind connects us scientifically, historically, and existentially. It's a great pleasure to welcome Simon Winchester. Thank you very much for being here. I always love when you're here. I enjoy talking to you.
You're very sweet. Thank you so much, Jeff.
So, the obvious question is, and I won't even make it a question. I'll make it a statement and then you can react. But it seems to me that looking at your career, that eventually you would write about wind.
It's a weird thing to say. I mean, my publisher was at first very apprehensive, very skeptical, didn't think that this would be something from which you could derive stories or very much of interest at all. But she has now completely changed her tune and likes the book a lot. But it took some, I think of all the books I've done in recent years, this was the most difficult to persuade my publisher to get on board with, as it were. But anyway, now it's there. And it all came about, really, because of a small piece in The Guardian, the newspaper I used to work for years and years ago, which said that the world's wind patterns are changing in a way which could be profoundly important for the world. The average wind speed in continental Europe, and it turns out to be true in continental America as well, in the first 15 years of this millennium, have been dropping 10% or so. And this seems to go absolutely against what we see and hear on our radio and television stations, where hurricanes are getting stronger, tornadoes are getting more frequent, cyclones and so on and so forth. But no, the average wind speed is dropping, and we are in the midst of what's called the Great Terrestrial Stilling. And I thought, having read that, well, that's interesting in and of itself, but perhaps the wind itself is interesting. And I started digging into it, and lo and behold, it turned out to be very interesting indeed. Whether we're in the grip of the stilling is another matter we can discuss maybe later on, but it's something weird is going on all over the world and involves wind.
It seems that, and the reason I asked the first question is that when you're, whether you're writing about language or water or geology, infrastructure, that they are these forces that certainly shape civilization. And this is another one of those. So that's a natural curiosity that you have to explore.
It sort of seems so. I mean, it's, although, as I mentioned at the beginning, this to my editor anyway seemed the most improbable. Must you really? But but she caved pretty quickly. But interestingly, to go back to the whole stilling thing, I experienced it in a practical and very interesting way in a place that is important to all our listeners, really, because Paul Kaner mentions it every single weekday morning when he talks about the weather on the summit of Mount Washington. I had gone there for my 80th birthday now, a year and a half ago, 20 of my chums. We all assembled at the bottom of the Cog Railway, went up to the top to see, I'd arranged it ahead of time, with the wind observers who are up there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And they explained to me how they did what they do, and heroically so. But all their instruments were clicking away, and you know, graphs and machines were whirring and whizzing, except when it came to the big sort of speedometer dials that showed what the wind speed was on the summit of Mount Washington that particular day. There was no wind at all. And the volunteers who were up there, when I pressed them, because they knew what I was writing about, they said they looked sort of sheepish and said, yes, it's really weird. The windiest place in the world, and this is a place that had recorded a wind speed of 231 miles an hour back in the 1930s, well, the highest wind speed up to that point ever recorded on this planet. There was no wind at all. So this very much played into the idea that we were in the grip of this stilling. Things have changed since, but nonetheless, Mount Washington that day, as I'm sure Paul Kiono mentioned that day, the wind today, zero.
When you think of how this subject has been thought of, explored, written about, talked about, going back in history as far as we can think, that it has had a profound thoughtfulness of the moving of the air, of how it was eventually even defined as wind.
Well, exactly. And initially, and of course we have to go back to the written record, and the written record only begins with the Sumerians about 3,500 years BCE, so 6,000 years ago. The first word written in cuneiform actually looks like the wind. It's three horizontal lines, like whoosh, you know, like the Nike whoosh on a pair of sneakers. The first word was illy. It doesn't sound anything to do with wind, but the look of it was. But even then, in fact, more than even then, for the next 3,500 years, people recorded it, wrote about it, were terrified by it, frightened by it, pleased by it, but believed it to be solely the work of the gods, which is why I gave it the title The Breath of the Gods. That's what they thought it was. And it was up to Aristotle. I mean, we always or so often come back to Aristotle as the person who first reasoned why it might be. And he simply reckoned, this is what, 300 years BCE, that when you warm air, it rises, okay? And then cooler air moves in from the sides to fill the gap left by the rising air. And that moving in is wind. I mean, the OED defines wind as the movement of air. Well, why does it move? It moves because warmer air gets out of the way and it has to be filled by something. And you can complicate it all you like, and it's one of the most mathematical of disciplines known, meteorology. Very, very complicated. But in its simplest form, it's all to do with that. You have an atmosphere, you warm it, it rises, cooler air comes in from the side. That is wind.
Just going back to something you mentioned of the title of the book, The Breath of the Gods, and how that was referred to. I mean, that gives such a power to what it is, doesn't it?
It really does. And of course, anemoi, from which we get the word anemometer, and then all the Greek names, Boreas, the northern winds, and so forth, it inhabits our language today very much. And when we're at sea, when we're cursing or blessing the wind, we still ascribe to it some sort of divinity, some divine power, because it is in so many ways beyond our comprehension. How can the wind behave with such enormous power? However, it has to be recognized that the practical use of it is what interests me particularly. Imagine you're in Mesopotamia between the Tigris and the Euphrates. You're walking through the desert and you come to this big river, the Euphrates. You see a log floating past. You might even get astride it and you're being carried downstream. But then someone realizes that if you put a vertical pole into the top of that log and from that pole put a dried animal skin, a sheepskin, a goatskin or whatever, you can get the wind to blow you along. And by changing the angle of the sail you've created, you can decide where to go. You can cross the river if you like. So Thor Heyerdahl, the great Pacific explorer, remarked quite presciently, man hoisted the first sail long before he made the first wheel. So wind-powered journeying was one of the earliest manners in which humankind crossed any desert, any plain, any place.
And you touch on this in the book, but it seems that we are still often surprised by the power of the wind, of what the wind can do. And it can just take a hurricane forecast to see, most recently in Jamaica, to see what is possible with wind. And we're still shocked by that.
We remain totally shocked by the power of it. And of course, that aspect of it is getting more and more dramatic. And what happens at sea with the turbulence of the water that's kicked up by these waves. But I begin the book, or at least I try and organize the book. There are explanatory chapters, you know, why it blows, how long we've named it, and so on and so forth. But basically three categories: gentle winds, working winds, and terrifying winds. And each one of those categories has its own importance. And one particular incidence I'd like to talk about is the way that gentle winds pick up particles and blow them, and with those particles do remarkable things, which may be less dramatic than you see in a typhoon or a hurricane, but can be nonetheless profoundly important. And a very good example of that, well, let me tell you if I may, I was in my kitchen in Oxford in England in 1986 making a cup of coffee, and suddenly the BBC broke into its afternoon broadcasting, which it seldom does, and says that there's a powerful plume of radiation, nuclear radiation, has been noticed north of Stockholm in Sweden. And it appears to indicate that there's been a catastrophe somewhere at a nuclear power station. The prevailing wind on that particular day came from the southeast. So if they tracked the plume back, it went over the Baltic, over the Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, over the Iron Curtain, because this was at the time, of course, of the Soviet Union, and into southwestern Soviet Union, to the Ukraine, where there was a power station called Chernobyl, and it appeared that something bad had happened there. But Radio Moscow said, no, nothing's happened at all, just keep moving, nothing to see here. But the plume kept coming and kept coming. And eventually the Soviets had to accept that, yes, there had been a disaster and they needed help. Now, the interesting thing is that on that April day, the normal prevailing wind would be from the west. And had the westerly wind been blowing as it usually did over Chernobyl, that radiation plume would have passed over the steppes and eventually Kazakhstan. No one would have known outside the Soviet Union. They could have kept completely quiet about it. But because it blew from the southeast, we in the West knew about it very rapidly. Gorbachev said later that the collapse of the Soviet Union, which happened only 5 years later in 1991, began with the disaster at Chernobyl and the realization, which of course spread throughout the Soviet Union itself once it had spread to the West. It started undoing everything. So a tiny little thing, a shift in the wind, the picking up of small, almost imperceptible particles of very, very light weights blown by gentle winds, which happened on that day to be coming from another direction, caused the collapse of the Soviet Union. So big or small, winds can have an extraordinarily disproportionate effect.
Disproportionate in the sense that you can't keep things confined.
You can't. And of course, they completely are transnational. They blow everywhere.
Yes. Simon Winchester is our guest. The name of the new book is The Breath of the Gods, The History and Future of the Wind. The book is published by Harper. There's always moments where I fall in love with your books. And there's things that I'm thinking of and I'm like, well, that's probably too silly that you'll write about. And then you start writing about wind chimes. And I think, well, that's fascinating. And then you even go into how some of the pricey wind chimes. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to me that of how many things I believe in this particular part, and a small part of the book, but it's that we figured out how to make money off that too.
Indeed, and I write about in that. I mean, I think that particular section of the book begins with me writing about singing sands.
Yes.
Sand dunes that boom or whistle as you or the camel walks across it, which I think in it of itself is fascinating. But then I get on to the woodwind instruments and the oboe, and I find that Errico Morricone, Gabriel's oboe from The Mission, one of the most transcendently beautiful pieces of music I've ever heard, played by an oboe with a double reed, I had no idea that double reeds and single reeds were different animals, but they apparently are. And how the 20 or so 30 miles an hour of wind that we can blow out of our cheeks, who knew that it was 20 miles an hour that we could create, makes such wonderful music. So the adaptation of the wind to making sounds, whether natural or artificial, is I'm so glad you picked that up. You're the only interviewer thus far that has picked it up. Normally people are sort of hurricanes and all the rest of it, but no, this is a beautiful aspect of wind.
Well, yeah, so that's what I thought of, just a beautiful natural aspect of it. The other thing of talk about commerce, but and then we get into what you refer to in the book, I believe, as working wind, of windmills, and that have been around for centuries, mm-hmm. and yet we're still here again. We're still understanding how they can be used, the power of them, and what the pluses and, yes, even some minuses are.
Well, I talk about windmills for either, as in Holland, raising water or milling grain, of course, which and in Texas today you've got the air motor, which is still there after 150 years manufacturing in a little town called San Angelo, Texas, very much an icon of the West. But now we are now arguing about wind generated electricity, and that's a very interesting subject in and of itself. The first wind powered electrical generator was created in Scotland by a man called James Blythe, who built one in his garden. He lived in a little town called Marykirk on the North Sea coast, where there are very reliable easterly winds. And this thing, it was just after the electrical dynamo had been invented and just after Edison had created the light bulb. So all of a sudden, this ugly-looking device in his front garden, which he later put up on his roof, generated electricity and lit these light bulbs. And so Mr. Blythe was able to read at night and read in bed and have his dinner by electric light. And so efficient was this generator that he could bottle it, as it were, in Leyden jars and offer it to his neighbours. He'd go down the street and say, "Would you like some electricity? In fact, I can give you some light bulbs, because I've got an awful lot of them." And to a man, everyone in the village said, "Och, no, electricity generated this way is the work of the devil." And he said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, the only way that we'll use electricity is generated by coal, which underlay everything in that part of Scotland. And the coal mine owners did not want any competitor from something like wind to get in the way." So the idea of the fossil fuel lobby, which is, of course, militating against wind power to this day, it's nothing new. It's been going on for 150 years.
So with that, let me just read a sentence from the book. "A modern windmill, or wind turbine to be exact, is not so much a construction that invites affection or radiates pastoral comfort. Rather, it is something built out of an urgent necessity, a need for a better means of generating electricity, an invention made to wean society away from polluting ourselves into oblivion, and as such is a device that triggers in the public mind a certain degree of apprehension, being a stern reminder of how we all better shape up or else."
Did I write that?
Yes, it's a beautiful sentence.
Well, to me, I'm not so keen on solar power, because the construction of these solar panels is in itself it uses a lot of fossil fuels to make the solar panels. But there's a big testing station in Boston Harbor of the blades of these gigantic wind farms, and they stress them like an aircraft wing going up and down until they break. They're made of fiberglass. They're relatively benign in terms of manufacturing costs. And to me, it is the obvious way to generate electricity, because yes, they disturb the wind. We are extracting energy from the wind, but 20 or so miles beyond the blades of these wind farms, particularly the ones at sea, there's not even a ripple effect. It's as if the wind, we extract so little energy, it does no damage to the wind. That's the point. Uses no fossil fuel, causes no problems. It's the obvious way to generate electricity, but by gosh, you should see the number of hate mails I've had in recent days from people who are, think it's deeply offensive to in any way criticize the fossil fuel lobby.
I understand. It also, going back to something that we mentioned earlier when you were talking about the sails on a ship and how we could use it and use the wind to travel from one place to another. And that, of course, brings to mind flight and aeronautics. And that is something else, too, that you know, when you think of just, what, 100-some years of the Wright brothers and where we are now, that has been an amazing trajectory in a relatively short period of time in the use of the wind.
It's extraordinary how rapidly this has developed. And we take it for granted now that we sit in perfect comfort in a nice, relatively comfortable chair and eat halfway decent food 7 miles above the surface of the earth and whiz along, as I did very recently, from Miami back to New York in a couple of hours, when less than 100 years ago, that would have taken weeks to do that journey in incredible misery and, I don't know. And yet this all came about, really, from people like the Wright brothers, not sort of on a whim doing this. They studied it. They studied kites. They studied the mechanics of the aerofoil, and they got it right. So when they made that first flight at Kitty Hawk, and it was only, what, 100 feet or something,
yes,
but they had calculated and they got it right. That's what was so remarkable about them. And I applaud them wholly for having done that. Having said that, of course, traveling by air these days is often so miserable. I much prefer to travel by train. But there are not many trains in America, sad to say.
You say you can feel the phenomenon, you get it, the very basics of aerodynamic lift, and so the very basis of aviation, if you're ever lucky enough to be invited to sit in the cockpit of a commercial jetliner at takeoff. As you said, there's a lot of us sitting back there eating the food and perhaps trying not to listen to the in-flight announcement. And yet what's going on up front is quite extraordinary.
And you know, of course, Joe, I'm sure that one of the great writers about that just lives in Pittsfield, Mark Van Honecker, who's British Airways pilot, whose book, I think the title of How to Land a Plane is one of the best titles. It's akin to Snakes on a Plane. You've got to read that book.
But what's going on there is extraordinary.
It really is. And an interesting thing, which I'm smacking myself because I didn't actually write about it in the book, is the increasing number of clear air turbulence events. When you're crossing the Atlantic, it used to be quite literally plane sailing all the way. But now, for some reason that the meteorologists aren't entirely sure why it's happening, you get these pockets of clear air turbulence where suddenly the plane may drop 1,000 feet in a couple of seconds and everyone inside is thinking, oh my God, what's happening? Make sure you wear your safety belts throughout the flight. So interesting things are happening up there, and I think in the paperback I'll have to put something, talk to Mark about it anyway, he knows.
It's interesting, and I think we touched on this at the beginning of our conversation, but The fact that we certainly know much about wind now, we know more than we did, and yet it is changing. And that's the other thing. We have to realize that there are changes and stay up on that, which is interesting with certain CERNs or thoughts about science and
I mean, there are all sorts
investigating
of,
you're
absolutely right. I mean, if I give me examples, I mean, you think of Hawaii,
right?
You think of the trade winds. It
yes.
is blessed by these northeasterly trains all the time. Well, the meteorologists down at Honolulu International Airport noticed that in the 1970s, trade winds were blowing 350 days out of the year. You could always bet on the trades in Hawaii. Not any longer. 290 days. It's been reduced. So the trade wind patterns, the trade winds have all moved slightly to the north and no longer hit Hawaii as gently as they used to. Similarly, Tornado Alley in the western prairies is moving eastwards towards us. I mean, we're not going to get terrified about it yet. But nonetheless, big synoptic changes in weather patterns, which are, after all driven by the wind, are changing. The position of the jet stream is changing. The jet stream, which was only discovered in the 1930s, is changing. So why these things are changing? Well, that's the only constant. It's a sort of a Buddhist thing to say the only constant is actually change, and wind demonstrates that.
So not that I need another thing to worry about, but as I was reading the book, I'm thinking to myself, okay, but we are, and not to make this overtly political, but we're taking away money from NOAA and from forecasting and from the National Weather Service. The very things that will tell us about those trade winds, that will tell us about what is happening with tornadoes and hurricanes and what is happening in our country and around the world of being pulled away and pulled back and lessened in some way. I would argue I don't think there's ever a time for that, but now certainly doesn't seem to be the time for
certainly
that.
Certainly not. I mean, it's utterly disgraceful. I spent quite a lot of time in Hawaii doing research on a variety of things. The National Weather Service office, which is on the campus of the University of Hawaii, they have seven or so forecasters, highly skilled people, men and women, who are responsible for the entire Pacific Ocean. In other words, if there's a big episode, a borning in the Coral Sea north of Australia or near Indonesia, they know about it and they know about it early. But they're being privatized. Most of them are being stood down. And the whole idea of now the current administration is to make money and turn it over to these various, you know, the Weather Channel or so forth. I think it's the U.S. National Weather Service and NOAA in general, hugely respected organization. And it's being gutted, and it's a terrible shame, and it's a dangerous shame, too.
And given your perspective in the book, of compare that to elsewhere in the world, in the sense of where it's still being taken seriously.
It is still being very seriously taken in China, I have to say. I mean, I lived in China for a long time. They know their weather. They're very interested in their weather. Europe, too. I mean, the British Forecasting Centre in Bracknell, just west of London, is a big supercomputer, and they do remarkable things. But nowadays, the driving force in world weather research is in Beijing and Shanghai.
When you finish a book like this, you mention one case of, I should have mentioned that. But I would think it would be full of things like that, because it's such a vast subject, and there's so much there.
It is a vast subject, and people, generally speaking, the critics thus far have been kind, but occasionally I talk quite a lot about the literature of wind, and so
yes,
Conrad's Typhoon and my particular favourite book, Richard Hughes' In Hazard, describing a Caribbean hurricane. But they'll come up with other paintings I haven't seen and other poems I haven't read. And so that's always a pain, but that obtains with any book I've ever written. I think, oops, why didn't I mention that?
The latest is The Breath of the Gods, The History and Future of Wind. What is next?
Well, that's a very interesting thought. I'm supposedly writing a book on the history of silver, the metal. And oddly enough, I had a driver just the day before yesterday. He said, silver, I've collected all my money is in silver. Every time I have a spare few dollars, I buy a silver coin. A very sensible investment, and not gaudy at all, a delicate and wonderful, whatever its reputation because of Judas, silver is, to my mind, a fascinating and beautiful metal.
Well, that'll be fascinating to read. That curiosity keeps going, doesn't it?
Hasn't ended quite yet.
Excellent. Simon Winchester's latest is The Breath of the Gods, The History and Future of the Wind. It's published by Harper. You are such a joy to have on this program. I thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for the beautiful book, and thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you, Jaron. Thank you, WAMC.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.